Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 263. It's Monday, July 1st. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, first up, let's start with a Toledo-related story. This from Politico. Opioid deaths rose 50% during the pandemic. In these places, they fell. A federal plan to promote treatment and distribute overdose reversal drugs showed promise. Communities are trying to keep it going. A multi-year experiment in this working-class city on Lake Erie's banks holds clues to how America could get a handle on its overdose crisis, if politicians embrace the lessons. Fatal drug overdoses in the U.S. driven by the synthetic opioid fentanyl increased by more than half during the pandemic and remain near record levels. But in Lucas County, where Toledo is, they plummeted 20% between 2020 and 2022. Researchers credit the county's effort to bring together health department workers, treatment providers, clergy, and law enforcement to look at where overdoses and deaths were happening so they could target resources to where they were needed most. The community support, in turn, made it easier to overcome bureaucratic obstacles to get drug users into treatment. And now, people behind the initiative believe the approach could be a template for the country, if they can convince state and federal lawmakers to continue funding their efforts and to pass laws eliminating the red tape they encountered. That's what we're trying to move forward, but it's really hard, said Majida Berryman, Lucas County Supervisor of Overdose Prevention and Harm Reduction. Berryman and her colleagues are fighting a sense of resignation across the country and in Washington, caused by the pandemic spike. Congress recently allowed landmark opioid-fighting legislation enacted in 2018 to expire, and budgets are tight everywhere. Still, Lucas County defied the pandemic trend. It was one of 67 counties in four states to participate in Healing Community Study, a National Institutes of Health study that spent $350 million starting in 2019 to reduce fatal overdoses by 40%. Part of the study participants' problem in making a case to continue is that they didn't hit that goal. Pandemic headwinds and a rise in illicit fentanyl use made that impossible, according to a recent analysis that found the overall result statistically insignificant. But in Toledo, a data-focused approach showed promise. Federal funds paid for iPads to help collect and share data and offer videos to train people to use the opioid overdose reversal drug naloxone. It bought a mobile van for educational outreach and naloxone distribution, and it came with access to a staff who coordinated and analyzed data, designed interventions, and helped with marketing. The data provided a clearer view of Lucas County's drug problem, showing which zip codes and demographics were seeing the most overdose deaths. But then, at the end of last year, the project and federal money that came with it ended. Now, communities are having a hard time getting states to invest in their interventions and keep momentum going. This is the reality, said Nora Volkow, director of the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, the NIH unit that oversaw the study. We live in a country where you have these political decision processes that determine the access to treatment. Back in Toledo, the county's experience of late shows how even proven interventions can suffer under budgetary pressure now that Healing Communities is over. The funding the county receives from the state doesn't always line up with its needs. I don't have a ton of people that I can just dedicate to purely doing data reading. We don't even have an epidemiologist, said Berryman. There is hope that money from the state attorneys general's settlements with prescription opioid manufacturers and related parties blamed for fueling addiction epidemic, now in the tens of billions of dollars, could support the infrastructure healing communities built, but much of that funding hasn't been deployed, and politicians are navigating competing demands for the money. For now, Berryman and her coalition partners are stretching to keep their work going. The Lucas County Opiate Coalition gathered for a meeting last month at Toledo's Emergency Medical Service Training Center. The county's overdose prevention program coordinator, Anthony Dibble, kicked off the meeting with a rundown of the current stats. There were 231 overdose deaths in the county in 2022. 95% of those attributed to fentanyl. A lot of us know this, but people aren't using heroin anymore, said Dibble. People are using fentanyl. Only 6% of people who died of an overdose had heroin in their systems. Cocaine, though, was present in 45% of deaths. Methamphetamine showed up twice as much as they had the year before. Victoria Graham, regional director of Guidestone, Ohio, a treatment center, said that the patients may be switching to uppers like meth and cocaine because there's less perceived risk of overdose. She also noted it was harder to treat these patients. Opioids like fentanyl have replacement therapies, such as methadone and buprenorphine, that can help users transition. But there's no medication-assisted therapy for cocaine or methamphetamines. That's been a struggle, she said. Okay, well, this is a really good case study in public health. I almost had to stop from kind of laughing at some of the most kind of almost trite but true statements of that, you know, you can know something works and not get funding for it, or a good program, you know, ends because funding runs out. That's kind of the everyday story of public health. But this is interesting because, of course, public health is very data-driven. If you can get more specific information about your community, you can target what resources you do have more effectively and actually make a difference. Whereas programs that are more driven by kind of a blunt instrument often don't have the same kind of effect and don't have the same kind of effect as efficiently. Okay, well, next up from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News, in news of the obvious, U.S. Surgeon General declares gun violence a public health crisis. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy declared firearm violence a public health crisis as gun deaths and injuries punctuate daily life in America. On nearly every day of 2024 so far, a burst of gunfire has hit at least four people somewhere in the country. Some days, communities have endured four or five such shootings. The nation's top doctor called on policymakers to consider gun safety measures, such as bans on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines and universal background checks for all firearm purchases. His advisory also urges a significant increase in funding for research on gun injuries and deaths, as well as greater access to mental health care and trauma-informed resources for people who have experienced firearm violence. In 2022, more than 48,000 people were killed by guns in the U.S., or about 132 people a day, and suicides accounted for more than half of those deaths, according to the CDC. An additional 200-plus Americans seek emergency care for firearm injuries each day. No federal database records non-fatal gun injuries. The Office of the Surgeon General does not set or carry out gun policy, but historically its reports and warnings have nudged policymakers and lawmakers to act. Murthy, a physician, said he hoped to convey the broader toll of gun violence on the nation and the need for an urgent public health response. He cited soaring gun deaths among children and teens and noted that the mental health toll of firearm violence is far more profound and pervasive than many of us recognize. Every day that passes, we lose more kids to gun violence, Murthy said. The more children who are witnessing episodes of gun violence, the more children who are shot and survive that are dealing with a lifetime of physical and mental health impacts. Firearm-related homicides over the past decade and suicides over the past two decades have driven the sharp rise in gun deaths, the advisory says. Guns are the leading cause of death for children and teens, with higher death rates among Black and Hispanic youths. Researchers from Boston University found that during the height of the COVID pandemic, Black children were 100 times as likely as white children to experience gun injuries. Hispanic and Asian children also saw major increases in firearm assault injuries during that time. Murthy has long said gun violence should be framed as a health issue. He argued that the approach has been successful in combating significant societal problems, citing tobacco control efforts that took hold following the then Surgeon General's landmark 1964 report, concluding that smoking cigarettes caused lung cancer and other diseases. Murthy's move is one of several recent Biden administration actions designed to combat gun violence, as most gun-related measures remain political non-starters in Congress. Federal officials have allowed states to use Medicaid dollars to pay for gun violence prevention, and the White House has called on hospital executives and doctors to gather more data about gunshot injuries and to routinely counsel patients about the safe use of firearms. While available data points to tragic outcomes across American communities, government officials and public health researchers have long been stymied by sparse federal funding devoted to gun violence research and the scope of its health effects. I've been studying gun violence for about 33 years now, and there's still some really basic and fundamental questions I can't answer, said Daniel Webster, a gun violence researcher at Johns Hopkins University. To really understand gun violence, you need to do more than just look at publicly available surveillance data, he said. You need to actually do in-depth studies involving the populations at highest risk for shooting or being shot. A Brady Center for Gun Violence Prevention analysis found that of the 15 leading causes of death in the U.S., firearm injuries received the third lowest amount of federal research funding through the NIH for each person who died. So this is adjusted by the number of deaths. Wow. So it's not getting the attention that it deserves. The only causes of death that garnered less research funding per capita through NIH were poisonings were poisonings and falls, according to the analysis. Sonali Rajan, an adjunct associate professor of epidemiology at Columbia University, who researches the effects of gun violence on children, said political leaders and others need to reframe the debate on gun violence from crime to public health. We are raising a whole generation of children for whom exposure to gun violence is normal. Yikes. Okay, well, it's Supreme Court decision season, and there's a couple cases need to report on that are going to have profound impacts on public health. This from Stat News. Supreme Court undercuts regulators' authority across government. Federal agencies' longtime authority to regulate industries was significantly weakened by a Supreme Court decision on Friday. The 6-3 decision, though it stems from cases on fishing regulations, will ripple across government agencies that have broadly interpreted the powers handed to them by Congress since a 1984 decision known as Chevron. The so-called Chevron doctrine laid out that courts should generally defer to federal agencies' reasonable interpretations of their authority when issuing regulations. In practice, that meant that courts stayed away from limiting sweeping rules from agencies like Medicare and Medicaid and the Food and Drug Administration on how hospitals, biopharmaceutical companies, and other industry players operate. Public health and labor agencies also made broad regulations in the COVID-19 response that could be checked under new precedents. The ruling could breathe life into multiple legal challenges from pharmaceutical companies opposed to Medicare's drug pricing negotiation program and is sure to spawn new lawsuits in the hospital insurance industry, experts said. There's a lot of litigation coming, said Jamie Gregorian, an attorney at DLA Piper, who previously was a lobbyist for biotech companies and orthopedic surgeons. If I were a pharmaceutical company and there were limits on reimbursement to my drugs, or if I was a hospital and not getting the same reimbursement from Medicare, I'm going a litigation route that I would not have gone before because the field is no longer tilted against me, he said. Critics of the Chevron doctrine have long argued that it's illegal for regulators to make major decisions, those with, quote, vast economic or political significance, without congressional clearance. That so-called major questions doctrine has popped up repeatedly, particularly since the COVID-19 pandemic and lawsuits over vaccine requirements. Friday's decision is likely to produce large-scale disruption, Justice Elena Kagan wrote in her dissent. In one fell swoop, the majority today gives itself exclusive power over every open issue, no matter how expertise-driven or policy-laden, involving the meaning of regulatory law, Kagan said. As if it did not have enough on its own plate, the majority turns itself into the country's administrative czar. Here's how the ruling could reverberate across the federal government. Biden's price drug negotiation plan could be vulnerable. Multiple pharmaceutical companies have sued the administration over a law allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. While Congress made this provision of the Inflation Reduction Act fairly prescriptive, directing Medicare to negotiate prices for 10 drugs based on highest program spending, the agency still has to make policy decisions that are vulnerable to legal attacks. For instance, instead of defining drugs by the diseases they are approved to treat, officials lump together drugs with common active ingredients, expanding the number of drugs subject to price negotiation, and shortening the time before negotiation starts for some drugs. The fall of Chevron could reignite industry opposition to the program, resulting in more lawsuits, including lawsuits challenging additional key provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act, said Erica White, a public service and leadership development fellow at Arizona State University's law school. Hospitals could sue over their federal payments. Hospitals have tried to get the Supreme Court to strike down Chevron for years. In a 2022 case, the Supreme Court said Medicare had to reverse large cuts to their drug payments. But the justices ruled in favor of hospitals by saying the government did not follow the text of the law when making those drug cuts, technically never touching Chevron, but indirectly chipping away at its potency. Now that the Supreme Court has said that executive agencies like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services no longer have the luxury of interpreting vague law, healthcare companies will be more motivated to sue when regulations threaten to decrease their Medicare and Medicaid payments. Hospitals, doctors, and others also could be more emboldened to challenge healthcare's fraud and abuse laws. The Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General routinely issues alerts and opinions that explain how the government would approach fraud and abuse laws in certain situations, knowing that its interpretations are legitimate under Chevron. However, with that doctrine now gone, providers wanting more leeway on fraud laws could push to reverse these opinions, Gregorian said. The Food and Drug Administration could be hamstrung. The FDA in particular has gotten a lot of deference from the courts for its scientific and clinical expertise. Even with that deference, FDA lawyers are known for carefully building administrative records to avoid court challenges, and the Supreme Court ruling could slow FDA regulations and decisions even more. Jerry Masudi, a former chief counsel of the FDA, doubts the ruling will change the FDA's case-by-case decisions on product approvals, but he said the doctrine has been an important tool for reaching its policy objectives and defending its regulations. On Friday, vape manufacturers, for one, said they felt emboldened to challenge the agency's limits on sales. The ruling could also lead to uneven regulation from one part of the country to the next. With the courts free to interpret laws more broadly, plaintiffs might go forum shopping to challenge FDA rulings in favorable court districts. FDA may, where possible, narrowly follow such decisions only in the jurisdiction of the deciding court. It will be harder for the U.S. to respond to public health emergencies. The government's ability to respond to public health emergencies is particularly vulnerable to the ruling, because the government gets broad discretion to act in such emergencies without first undertaking the long process of rulemaking. A variety of temporary rules were put in place during the COVID-19 pandemic, such as allowing people to stay on Medicaid longer, funneling extra money to hospitals, and making telehealth regulations more lenient. Some vaccine authorizations were also linked to the declaration of a public health emergency. Absent Chevron, agencies may act more cautiously in an emergency because it will be easier to challenge their actions and rules. Protections for disabled people could become easier to challenge. The end of Chevron could upend the Americans with Disabilities Act and make the landmark civil rights bill much easier to challenge in federal court. The ADA prohibits state and local governments from discriminating against people with disabilities in public settings. Recently, the Justice Department expanded this mandate to include the internet and boost web accessibility. This is just one example of how new technologies can require a fresh interpretation of the ADA, said Hillary Jorgensen, co-executive director of the Colorado Cross Disability Coalition. Today, SCOTUS decision overturning Chevron is going to be catastrophic for the disability community, she said. It will be much more difficult for people with disabilities to enforce our rights under the ADA now that Chevron has been overturned. So this is going to be a sea change, and it's going to be many, many years as these cases, keep going up to the Supreme Court and being decided. This is very scary considering how scientifically illiterate the court has been on many basic things, but now you're going to throw literally hundreds of cases in hundreds of different areas where technical expertise is needed to make decisions. And like the FDA and the EPA, there are, entire staffs that are looking at things, that are balancing various things, like the public health benefit versus the economic cost and these type of things. now, basically, and rather than having the FDA or the EPA ultimately deciding that through a long, arduous process, they're going to have these things challenged and go before Supreme Court justices who don't really have the technical ability to understand, let alone decide, these cases. It's going to be very troubling. And of course, anytime Congress passes a law, there's going to be changes in society and evolutions besides maybe any initial little gaps where there's maybe some vagueness. But certainly as society changes, they need a little bit of flexibility to be able to move quickly into areas of rapid change, for instance, like the regulation of AI in healthcare or in the world at large. But unless you pass a new law for each and every one of these, or when the Supreme Court overrules one area, Congress is going to have to pass a whole new law in order to get at its original intent, for instance, because it wasn't, you know, is declared too vague or whatever. Yeah, this could be the worst ruling for public health law in a long, long time. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, let's look at a Supreme Court case that's a little bit more of a mixed bag in its many effects. This from Stat News. Upending Purdue Pharma's settlement does little to help today's opioid crisis, advocates say. The drug policy world has been left torn by the Supreme Court's ruling on Thursday that Purdue Pharma's bankruptcy deal could not move forward if it included legal protections for the company's billionaire owners. In one camp are those who are eager to see the agreed-upon $6 billion settlement put to work preventing and treating opioid addiction. In the other are those who found the prospect of shielding the Sackler family from civil lawsuits to be indefensible. But there's a third camp, too. One that argues Purdue, its infamous pain drug OxyContin, and the overall scandal are of little relevance to today's overdose epidemic, in which fentanyl, methamphetamine, and other illicit drugs combine to kill over 110,000 Americans each year. I won't argue against the emotional stance of a bereaved parent who lost a child to OxyContin, said Stephen Kertes, an addiction doctor and professor of medicine at the University of Alabama. But what got us into this crisis and what will get us out of it is a whole lot bigger than the execution of a revenge plan against owners of a company. With last Thursday's ruling, Purdue and many of the state attorneys general who sued the company pledged to restart negotiations on a new settlement agreement. But the clean slate is leading advocates to ponder whether pursuing justice for the dead, accountability for the Sacklers, and prevention of future deaths are fully compatible goals. Even as the Sacklers rose to infamy, however, the drug crisis was morphing from OxyContin to heroin, and later from heroin to fentanyl. Meanwhile, the U.S. has sharply cut its opioid prescribing rates, which Kertes and many pain patients now argue has caused a secondary crisis by driving Americans from regulated, predictable pain drugs to unregulated, volatile opioids like fentanyl. Where we are today is that the vast majority of people are not dying from prescription opioids, said Sarah Whaley, a researcher focused on substance use policy at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Our crisis is very much the illicitly manufactured synthetic opioids, like fentanyl. The funding landscape has also changed as other pharmaceutical companies, drug wholesalers, and pharmacies have also agreed to settle claims relating to their roles in the opioid crisis. Those settlements roughly total $50 billion, some of which is now flowing to governments and community organizations. While pursuing justice for the Sacklers may be cathartic, Kertes argued, it is unclear whether the Sackler status as a national pariah is motivating the type of systemic change needed, or whether, in his view, it simply constitutes another quick fix. Instead, Kertes said, the country requires a sweeping overhaul of its health system, including an emphasis on listening to patients and using long-proven tools like the addiction medication buprenorphine to help prevent future overdose deaths. The U.S. health system helped create healthcare payment schemes that punish time spent listening to patients and learning their problems while rewarding quick visits with high tech, he said. Those were policy decisions organized medicine negotiated long before Purdue Pharma came along to exploit them. And reality is, no one is trying to fix them. Still, the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision to derail Purdue's settlement process leaves in flux a sum of $6 billion that can't be used for treatment prevention or naloxone distribution. It also delays sizable payments to thousands of individual plaintiffs who sued Purdue on the part of lost loved ones. And while today's drug crisis bears little resemblance to the one Purdue helped fuel long ago, it's very easy to draw a line from one to the next. Where we are today is a product of what happened two decades ago with Purdue, she said. They're two separate things, but the impact that these settlements have today is that they resulted in additional resources that state and local governments can invest back into communities to address the crisis. To the loved ones of many recent overdose victims, Purdue and OxyContin don't represent a previous phase of the drug crisis, but rather an inescapable trauma. It's very raw for me and a lot of families, said Dita Bargava, a parent advocate in the nonprofit with the nonprofit advocacy group Shatterproof. Her oldest son, Alec, died in 2018 at 26. His addiction, she said, began with OxyContin. The pain of recent loss, coupled with the continued devastation of today's drug crisis, has left many members of the addiction and drug policy communities in an impossible bind. It's not clear-cut. There are many advocates who felt like we needed that money right away, Bargava said. We do. There are so many people out there who are suffering helplessly. But on the flip side of that, there are a lot of advocates, and I felt this way to a certain extent and still do, who feel the SACWers need to be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law. It's a choice that no one should have to make, Bargava said. The $6 billion is a drop in the bucket by federal spending standards, she added, and adequate responding to the overdose crisis should not come at the expense of holding the SACWers accountable, or vice versa. Perhaps as important as the funds, Bargava and others said, is what message the eventual end of the Purdue case will send, namely, whether it serves as a durable warning to potential corporate wrongdoers or instead suggests that a high enough dollar amount can erase their misdeeds. From a public health perspective, will it really make a difference? Perhaps not, said Regina LaBelle, a former high-ranking drug policy official in the Obama and Biden administrations and the director of the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative at Georgetown. But the justice system is about accountability and enforcing the rule of law. So, of course, drug epidemics have been shifting and relatively rapid moving for a long time. That's not anything new. So, of course, by the time you have these long legal cases being settled out, the reality at that time will be very different than the time from when the cases were initiated. So that's not really the point. But I do agree that if you allow the SACWers to get away with kind of protecting themselves from a whole slew of cases that could potentially come down in the future for fraud and negligent death, then, of course, future actors are not going to have the kind of disincentive to act in a similar fashion. Such are the ongoing challenges of public health. And the next story gets at how these long challenges, while you make some progress, it's very difficult. This from Stat News. National Academies proposes reimagining healthcare to fix, quote, fundamental flaws that underlie inequity. The nation's longstanding racial and ethnic health inequities will not improve unless Congress steps in to provide affordable health insurance for all and federal agencies start enforcing existing laws against discrimination and improve collection of racial and ethnic data, said the authors of a new report called Ending Unequal Treatment. It was issued by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, some two decades after the groundbreaking 2003 Unequal Treatment report laid bare the fact that people of color experienced the healthcare system differently and received worse care, regardless of income, social status, or education, and that structural racism ran rife throughout healthcare. Not much has changed, the new report said. 20 years later, it is clear that our nation has not made enough progress, said Victor Dizau, president of the National Academy of Medicine, in a statement. Their current system, by its very design, delivers different outcomes for different populations, the report said. Racial and ethnic inequalities remain fundamental flaws in the nation's healthcare system, have led to millions of premature deaths of Black, Brown, and Indigenous Americans, and cost the country hundreds of billions of dollars annually, the authors wrote. They call for the nation's healthcare system, which they said remains largely broken for the most marginalized patients, to be reimagined. Congress, they say, needs to establish a pathway for affordable health insurance for all, reimburse Medicaid providers at the same rate as Medicare providers, and better fund the Indian Health Service. The report mirrors a 2022 investigation by STAT that found 20 years after unequal treatment was released, dishearteningly little progress has been made to end racial health disparities, and many are worse today. A study last year found Black Americans suffered 1.63 million excess deaths and lost more than 80 million years of life in the past 20 years compared to white Americans. Other specific recommendations for Congress and federal agencies, including Department of Health and Human Services and National Institutes of Health and the Office of Management and Budget, include improving the spotty and inconsistent collection of race and ethnicity data on both patients and healthcare workers by having the Department of Health and Human Services make sure programs under its oversight collect and report this data, with monitoring by the Office of Management and Budget. Allocating increased funding to allow healthcare systems to implement solutions known to improve health equity, such as the use of patient navigators and community health workers, and have Health and Human Service agencies set clear, enforceable standards to hold health systems accountable for implementing these solutions. Expanding federal research on health inequities, structural racism, health-related social needs, and community-based research. The report said only a paucity of resources have been devoted to health equity research despite the magnitude of the problem. Better funding the Office of Civil Rights and Health and Human Services so it can enforce existing but underused laws against discrimination, including Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, which specifically addresses discrimination. Many of the tools needed to reach these goals are already available and need to be fully used, said committee co-chair Jennifer DeVoe, professor and chair of family medicine, Oregon Health and Science University. The study was sponsored by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and the National Institutes of Health. It chronicles a long list of racial and ethnic inequities for patients from marginalized groups, from living shorter lives and being more likely to die in childbirth, to being less likely to have a regular source of primary care, and receiving care from long-term care facilities with less staff and more deficiencies. Health equity researchers welcomed the new recommendations, but some said they do not go far enough. They noted that health inequities are tied not only to the healthcare system, but to larger social problems, such as housing and neighborhood inequality, living in areas that have little fresh food or few safe places to exercise, poverty, inequities in educational opportunities, and other conditions that plague Black and Indigenous Americans more than other groups. The recommendations of all have merit, but they don't go far enough because they don't address structural racism as an underlying cause of health disparities, said Lewis Penner, a health disparities researcher and professor emeritus in the Department of Oncology at Wayne State University. In a recent book, Unequal Health, Penner and three co-authors came to a similar conclusion as the new report, that improving health disparities will not be possible without significant change. But the book focused on changes both within healthcare and outside of it, arguing that achieving health equity requires addressing the lack of socioeconomic opportunities and inherited wealth faced by many Black Americans, expanding educational opportunities, reducing discrimination in general and within law enforcement, and improving neighborhood and housing quality, among other steps. A National Academies report issued roughly a year ago went further in urging the federal government to improve health through social changes, such as increased wages, housing vouchers, and more equitable education spending. One thing that changed markedly in the past two decades is terminology and thinking about what causes inequities. While the unequal treatment report suggested that equity would occur if all patients were treated equally regardless of race or ethnicity, it has become clear that health inequities are often the result of historical disadvantages and that truly equitable health care takes these unfair circumstances into account when making treatment decisions. The report comes amid a national conversation about what it will take to improve health for marginalized communities. At a panel on structural racism in health at Aspen Ideas Health last weekend, Aletha Maybank, the American Medical Association's Chief Health Equity Officer and Senior Vice President, said it was time to move beyond simply studying inequities. "We have so much data," she said. "We don't need more data to know these disparities exist." Many speakers said the work today was harder, but even more important, given the pushback against DEI efforts occurring through legal and political battles. Rachel Hardiman, who directs the Center for Anti-Racism Health Research for Health Equity at the University of Minnesota, said that the fight would be long but must be deliberate, despite the urgency of the problem highlighted by the COVID-19 pandemic and the death of George Floyd. urgency culture is actually harmful in this work in a lot of ways, she said. So I find that last quote one of the most fascinating because, you know, we run from crisis to crisis. Our culture is really good at that. And that urgency culture actually precludes and short circuits a lot of the longer, slow, plodding work that's necessary to make the changes to have a truly equitable society. And here at Just for the Health of It, we're in that long-term project.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment, from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones, from daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, let's do some stories on some of the effects after the fall of Roe v. Wade. This from MedPage Today. Infant deaths increased after Texas ban on abortion in early pregnancy. A 2021 Texas ban on abortion in early pregnancy was associated with increases in infant and neonatal deaths, according to a population-based cohort study. From 2021 to 2022, infant deaths in Texas increased by 13%, from 1985 to 2,240, while infant deaths across the rest of the U.S. increased by 1.8%. That represents an excess of 216 infant deaths occurring from March to December in 2022, a 12.7% increase above expectation, they noted in JAMA Pediatrics. Corresponding estimates for neonatal deaths showed a similar pattern in Texas, increasing 10.4% from 1,295 deaths to 1,430 deaths, compared with only a 1.6% increase in neonatal deaths in the rest of the country. In 2021, Texas Senate Bill 8 was passed, which prohibited abortions after embryonic cardiac activity and did not allow exemptions for congenital anomalies. Among the top 10 causes of infant deaths, there was a 23% increase in congenital anomalies in Texas, compared with a 3.1% decrease for the rest of the U.S. Texas also appears to have, quote, unique increases compared with the rest of the country for infant deaths attributed to unintentional injuries, with a 21% increase versus 1% in the rest of the country, and necrotizing enterocolitis of the newborn, which increased 73% in Texas and just 6% in the rest of the country. So to put all this in context, there's been a lot of focus on the risks to the moms, which of course is very tragic and will likely result in hundreds of more deaths. But we're actually seeing just in Texas alone hundreds of deaths of newborns. These neonatal deaths due to restrictions of abortion access. And of course, these restrictive abortion laws have even more effects, as this next story elucidates from MedPage Today. Oral and emergency contraceptive use fell in states with abortion bans. States with abortion restrictions triggered by the Dobbs decision saw a decline in prescriptions of oral contraceptives, particularly emergency contraceptives. And while fills for emergency contraceptives increased in both groups in the year following Dobbs, after the one-year mark, prescriptions for emergency contraceptives fell by 65% in restrictive states, as reported in JAMA Network Open. Prior to the Dobbs decision, the monthly fill rates for oral and emergency contraceptives was similar between the two groups of states. The Dobbs decision led to the closure of many family planning clinics and confusion around the legality of emergency contraceptions. So this is a more indirect effect of these abortion restrictions. They've shut down family planning clinics and created a lot of chaos and confusion. And that has led to decreased use of just regular oral contraceptives and, in particular, emergency contraceptives. And of course, people, particularly women, recognize these effects, and it's driving an increase in permanent sterilizations. This from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Rate of young women getting sterilized doubled after Roe was overturned. After Roe was overturned in June 2022, doctors said a wave of young people started asking for permanent birth control, like tubal ligations, in which the fallopian tubes are removed, or vasectomies in men. New research published this spring in JAMA Health Forum shows how big that wave of young people is nationally. University of Pittsburgh researcher Jackie Ellison and her co-authors used TriNetX, a national medical record database, to look at how many 18 to 30-year-olds were getting sterilized before and after the ruling. They found sharp increases in both male and female sterilization. Tubal ligations doubled from June 2022 to September 2023, and vasectomies increased over three times during that same time. Even with that increase, women are still getting sterilized much more often than men. Vasectomies have leveled off at the new higher rate, while tubal ligations still appear to be increasing. Montana-based OB-GYN Gina Nelson said she's seeing women of all ages, with and without children, seeking sterilization because of Supreme Court Dobbs' decision. She said the biggest change is among young patients who don't have children seeking sterilization. She said that's a big shift from when we started practicing 30 years ago. Okay, well, next let's turn to a healthcare story, this one about prescription drugs. This from NPR. Health insurers cover fewer drugs and make them harder to get. Insurance coverage isn't what it used to be when it comes to prescription drugs. Insurance companies' lists of covered drugs, called formularies, are shrinking. In 2010, the average Medicare formulary covered about three-quarters of all drugs approved by the Food and Drug Administration, according to new research by GoodRx, a website that helps patients find discounts on prescription drugs. Now, it's a little more than half. The GoodRx report is called The Big Pinch because it illustrates how patients are pinched between the drug company's high prices and their health insurance company's limited drug coverage. I think far too often people talk way too much about the cost of their prescriptions, and we're screaming about the high cost of prescriptions, says Tori Marsh, director of research at GoodRx. But what we're not talking about is the poor coverage. Commercial plans likely cover even fewer drugs than Medicare plans do, because they're not bound by the same federal coverage mandates as Medicare. What's more, according to the report, patients have to clear more hurdles to get the drugs that are covered by their insurance than they did 14 years ago. Half the drugs insurance companies cover require things like prior authorization, in which insurers require doctors to take an additional step of justifying why they've written a prescription. This step can cause delays and make it harder for patients to get drugs their doctors prescribe, or deter people from filling their prescriptions altogether. Yes, just one more story in the ongoing saga of the decline of American healthcare. Yes, you can have a PhD and not be able to figure out prescription drug coverage in America. Okay, well, let's end our regular reporting with two stories on revised vaccine recommendations. First up from MedPage Today, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices makes changes to the adult RSV vaccine recommendations. All adults aged 75 years and older should receive a single dose of any RSV vaccine, and adults aged 60 to 74 years who are at increased risk of severe RSV disease should receive a vaccine, according to a unanimous 11-0 vote by the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Also, people who have already received the RSV vaccine are not recommended to receive a booster, based on data that showed another dose does not improve outcomes. Although the vaccine is universally recommended for those 75 and older, adults 60 to 74 who are not at increased risk of severe disease do not need to receive an RSV vaccine. Who exactly is at high risk for severe disease? The committee offered a list of chronic medical conditions associated with the risk for severe RSV disease, such as lung disease, cardiovascular disease, moderate or severe immune compromise, diabetes with organ damage, severe obesity, and other systemic diseases. And this list will be provided by the CDC. And second up on vaccine recommendations, this is from Medical Express. CDC advises updated COVID vaccine for everyone over 6 months of age. As a summer wave of COVID infections rolls across the country, U.S. health officials have recommended that all Americans over the age of 6 months get one of the updated COVID vaccines when they become available this fall. The recommendation recommendation was issued last Thursday by the U.S. CDC after its vaccine advisory panel weighed in on who should get the shots. The panel made the same recommendation for flu vaccinations this fall, with rare exceptions. Our top recommendation for protecting yourself and your loved ones from respiratory illness is to get vaccinated, CDC Director Dr. Mandy Cohen said. Make a plan now for you and your family to get both updated flu and COVID vaccines this fall, ahead of the respiratory virus season. Professionals and the public in general do not understand how much this virus has mutated, said Carol Hayes, the CDC Vaccine Advisory Committee's liaison to the American College of Nurse Midwives. For Americans who decide to get the latest COVID shots, there will be a choice among this year's vaccines. The Novavax shot will target JN1, the variant that prevailed during the winter, while the Pfizer and Moderna shots will take aim at KP2, which until recently seemed poised to become the dominant variant. But two related variants, KP3 and LB1, now account for more than half of new cases. All three variants are descendants of JN1. So this just shows you how quickly the virus is mutating. It's hard to even keep up, which is all the more reason to update kind of your immune profile with a new vaccine. While mutations are thought to help the variants evade immune defenses and spread faster, there's no evidence they cause more severe illness, the CDC said. But of course, in public health, if you have a disease that's more infectious, in other words, more people get it, from a population point of view, that's more serious. While each individual case may not be more serious, the more cases you have is more serious of a public health problem. The biggest risk factor for severe illness is age. Americans 65 and older account for 2/3 of COVID hospitalizations and 82% of in-hospital deaths. Yet only about 40% of Americans in that age group were immunized with the COVID vaccines that were offered last fall. And of course, this is true for most health problems, that it's concentrated in older folks. Children, particularly those under the age of 5, are also vulnerable, but only about 14% got COVID vaccines last fall. It is also critical that pregnant persons get vaccinated, not only to protect themselves, but also to protect their infants until they are old enough to be vaccinated, panelist Dr. Denise Jameson, Dean of the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa, said. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. 27 bonus articles this week. First up, Supreme Court okays local crackdowns on homelessness as advocates warn of chaos. So the Supreme Court said it's okay to criminalize people who don't have a home, a private place to sleep, by sleeping at all, which would be in a public place. Yikes. We are getting meaner, folks. Meaner. Bonus article 2. U.S. Supreme Court Purdue Pharma ruling makes mass litigation tougher to discharge in bankruptcy. So this can be a good thing, as a lot of corporations try to escape some of these mass litigation problems through the bankruptcy laws. Bonus article 3. Big story for Ohio. Train derailment in Ohio led to unnecessary chemical burn, says National Transportation Safety Board. So this is really big news in that we've just learned that they had information from the company that produced the vinyl chloride that they ended up burning in mass and spewing over many, many states, that it was actually getting reduced in temperature, becoming more safe rather than at a point where it needed to be burned. The governor and others didn't know that, so they made an ill-informed decision to burn it. Bonus article 4. Garbage dumps may be burping toxic forever chemicals. As we learn more and more about forever chemicals, this can be that they have volatile compounds that can be released as a gas. Yikes. Bonus article 5. Cleaning sponges release vast amounts of microplastics monthly. So we've learned that pretty much anything made out of plastic can deteriorate and be released in the environment. Of course, cleaning sponges goes right into the water supply or on our food, into our kitchens where food is prepared. Yikes. Bonus article 6. Forever chemicals can penetrate skin from personal care products. Believe it or not, we didn't even know that necessarily before. New study shows that, in fact, it is true. In a similar story, bonus article 7, alarming study unveils how forever chemicals transfer from mothers to newborns. So this is a problem when we're talking about the buildup over generations and the accumulation of one generation, the moms, can actually be transferred to newborns. Bad news. Bonus Article 8, PFAS-contaminated sludge endangers farmers' health. A new federal program could empower them to address this pollution crisis. So we're seeing that PFAS, these forever chemicals, are contaminated in the sludge. That's basically waste that's being processed and used as fertilizer on farms. And of course, that's being concentrated around where farmers live, and they are particularly susceptible to that. A lot of those places have wells, and well water can be contaminated. Bonus Article 9, clothes, cookware, floss, Colorado law to ban everyday products with PFAS. So this is an attempt that in lieu of more aggressive federal regulations, states are trying to ban the onslaught of PFASs in our life. Good luck, Colorado. Be a leader. Bonus Article 10. Lead water pipes created a health disaster in Flint, but cheaper plastic pipes carry hidden costs. I reported this on before, and the fact that those pipes, they actually don't last as long as the other pipes, but they also leak plastic chemicals into the water. Not good. Bonus Article 11. Most kids get unneeded antibiotics for pink eye. So besides a waste from healthcare perspective, it's a driver of antimicrobial resistance by using antibiotics unnecessarily. Bonus Article 12. Did cold medications affect Biden's debate performance? So if you didn't know, he had a cold, and some people say that he did a little better later than he did earlier. If he doped himself up on cold medications, healthcare providers know that when an older person particularly presents with some confusion issues and such, that often they look for the effects of cold medications, which of course is not a permanent problem. It's a transient problem when you're under the influence of cold medications. Interesting hypothesis. Bonus Article 13, smallest businesses feel crush of healthcare costs. This is just the fact that the proportion that they're spending to cover healthcare costs is higher than larger businesses. This is bad for entrepreneurship. And also a good example of how if we had a functioning healthcare system, such as a universal healthcare system, it would actually fuel entrepreneurialism. It would allow entrepreneurs to not be punished disproportionately for healthcare costs. Bonus Article 14. In a first, cooling costs for public housing residents will be a covered utility. I didn't even realize this before. They can cover everything, but you have to pay extra to have an air conditioner run. They may have the air conditioner in the public housing unit, but if you want to use it, you've got to pay for that, but not your other electricity. Yeah, kind of interesting. That's a changing world with climate change. Good change. Bonus Article 15. Telehealth for medication abortion worked as well as in-person visit with ultrasound. Just more evidence that abortion is a very safe and effective procedure. Bonus Article 16. Over half of U.S. women on probation or parole need permission to travel for abortion. This is particularly true in the southern states where there's a lot of women on probation or parole and there's a lot of abortion restrictions. So 400,000 U.S. women are now added to that category where they need permission to travel for abortion from a court. Bonus Article 17. Voters in 25 U.S. states can't back abortion in citizen-led ballot measures because those citizen-led ballot measures are not available in their state. So much for throwing it back to the states. Bonus Article 18. By the numbers, America's alcohol-related health problems are rising fast. A good overview of the many problems in public health related to alcohol use and misuse. Bonus Article 19. Yes, gun violence is a public health issue. So this is from one of my favorites, My Epidemiologist. This is a good overview of gun violence as a public health issue. Bonus Article 20. New Yorkers were choked, beaten, tased by New York Police Department officers. The commissioner buried their cases. Just another example of the impunity in law enforcement that doesn't service so many levels and suffering violence by those who are supposed to protect us from violence. Bonus Article 21. 3 months into bird flu outbreak in U.S. dairy cows, experts see deep-rooted problems in response. Another good overview and update on bird flu. Bonus Article 22. CDC issues dengue fever alert in the U.S. So the numbers aren't huge, but it's rising. There is a dengue fever outbreaks around the world. And we're seeing a rise also in the U.S., but it's something that now doctors, it's high enough that doctors need to take a look on the radar for dengue fever, particularly in southern places where the mosquito-borne diseases are going to be more prevalent. Bonus article 23. Moderna says its RSV shot is 50% effective across the second season. So this is true for the other two shots as well, even probably more effectiveness than that. This is why they're not recommending RSV to get another shot the next year, because the initial shot you get protects you for at least two seasons. Good news. Bonus article 24. A multivitamin a day does not increase longevity. We've known for a long time that there's been very disappointing when looking at multivitamins in improving health, and apparently it doesn't increase longevity. Bonus article 25, your gut microbes may influence how you handle stress. So, the multivitamin is kind of the pharmaceutical approach where you just kind of punch in stuff, a drug, a bunch of vitamins, trying to improve your health, and how that doesn't work. But your gut microbes is something that's influenced by your overall diet and is a big bonus for a plant-based whole foods diet. Is the best thing you can do for your gut microbes, and it seems increasingly true that it can affect how you handle stress and affect your mood. Bonus article 26. Despite risks, aspirin use remains high among older adults. So about a third of older adults are using aspirin for the primary prevention of heart disease, and others trying to avoid that first heart attack. Aspirin use may be justified if you've already had a heart attack. This was a recommendation that was given years ago, but has been kind of debunked since. So update your practices. Bonus article 27. Sedentariness continues to rise globally. So we live in a world that has less and less physical activity and more sedentary folks. So exercise is one of those basic things you can do to improve your health in so many ways. Go to it. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.